Planned Parenthood is suing the state of Wisconsin. The organization wants more medical professionals allowed to prescribe abortion-inducing pills. The state has argued its laws are constitutional and shouldn't need to change. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. This isn't a debate about the ethics of abortion. It is a conversation about access and the Constitution. And we welcome you to join in. 800-642-1234 is the number you can call to weigh in here. Perhaps you have experience in this area. How do you see access to abortion changing in the coming years? What is it like in your part of Wisconsin? 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Mike Murray is the Vice President of Government Affairs and External Relations for Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. He's also the Executive Director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin, which is the nonprofit organization's advocacy arm. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Keely, so much for having me.
Your organization filed this lawsuit at the beginning of 2019. What was the reason?
Well, the reason that we filed this lawsuit is because we believe that these three provisions in state law unconstitutionally and unnecessarily hinder the ability of patients to access abortion care when they need it in the state. And these laws are an actual hindrance on the health and safety of the patients that we serve around the state of Wisconsin.
And your quick list of those three facets of it are what?
So the three separate statutes that we are challenging are what's called the physician-only restriction, which only allows physicians to provide abortion care in the state of Wisconsin, even though there are other advanced practice clinicians that routinely provide identical types of treatment and care for other medical care, both in Wisconsin, and then there are other states as well where these other types of advanced practice clinicians actually do provide abortion care. There's also the same physician restriction, which requires patients to see the same physician at both state-mandated abortion care visits that they have to go to. And then the physical presence restriction, which basically bans the use of telemedicine for medication abortion care.
Let's walk through each of those because we can start with the last one, the physical presence restriction. How has COVID-19 given additional context to this part of the conversation for you?
Well, I think COVID-19 is a really good example about how this restriction really impacts the access to care that patients have in the state. So as most folks are probably aware, COVID-19 has really magnified the importance of having telemedicine as an option for patients to access the health care that they need. COVID-19 has sort of magnified the existing inequities that we see in our healthcare system for communities and individuals that have traditionally had difficulty accessing care and experience significant healthcare disparities in our states. So that's people of color, people with low incomes, and people living in rural areas already face significant barriers to accessing care. And COVID-19 has just further magnified that. So one of the things that we have done at Planned Parenthood is tried to make sure that folks have the opportunity to access our family planning services via telehealth. And that's been a really successful way to ensure that folks are still able to access the care that they need. Unfortunately, state law prohibits the use of telemedicine for medication abortion care, which even in normal times greatly restricts patients' access to that care, and only further does so in times of COVID-19.
And medication abortion is exactly what it sounds like. It requires medicine as opposed to some sort of surgical procedure. And yet people who do think that a doctor should be physically present when those pills are handed out say medical abortions don't come without risk. And so you need the observation of a physician there. How do you respond?
I would say that if folks really believe that was a necessary restriction for this type of care, then our laws would actually reflect that. The fact is that our physician only restriction and the same physician restriction and the physical presence restriction are only applicable to abortion care. There are plenty of other identical medical procedures where there is not a state mandate that the same physician be present when the medication is dispensed. So for example, what a lot of folks might be familiar with is early pregnancy loss care, or what for most some folks might say call miscarriage management. You use the same identical medication regimen to provide that type of care. And there is not a state statute that requires that a physician be present, the same physician be present when that medication is handed out for the exact same type of medical care.
And what it sounds like you're talking about is when a fetus dies, when a pregnancy can't continue, but the woman's body doesn't get rid of it on its own. And so you prescribe medicine to the woman so that she doesn't develop infection, things like that. Is that what you're referring to?
That's exactly right. So the same medication that is prescribed for a medication abortion is the same medication that would be prescribed for early pregnancy loss.
We're talking about abortion access in Wisconsin with Mike Murray. He's Vice President of Government Affairs and External Relations for Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Did you try to have an abortion but had trouble locating a clinic that could help? What obstacles did you run into in finding information? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. What does access to abortion look like in your part of the state? Do you think that matters? 800-642-1234. Mike, let's talk about the fact that Wisconsin allows doctors to provide medications that induce abortions. Your suit and what you've said here, it references the idea that nurse practitioners and nurse midwives should be able to, too. Why?
Because nurse midwives and nurse practitioners are actually qualified to provide that type of care. And as I stated earlier, they actually do provide that type of care in other contexts in the state of Wisconsin. So in regard to early pregnancy loss. And also in other states, those types of advanced practice clinicians actually do provide medication abortion care to patients directly.
And that other restriction you target is this requirement that women seeking an abortion with medication see the same doctor for two visits. Why do you think that this is against the Constitution?
Well, again, this restriction is a restriction that is unique to abortion care, and it singles out this type of medical care that women across the state absolutely need access to, and creates a completely medically unnecessary restriction to accessing that care. When say, for example, when I go to the hospital for a heart condition, and I see a cardiologist on day one who prescribes me a medication for that heart condition, but then I have to go to a follow-up appointment the next day for further examination and to receive the medication I was prescribed. I absolutely do not have to see the same physician to do that, and I actually might be receiving medication that poses greater risks to my health than the medication that's involved in a medication abortion. The fact is that when most folks access healthcare, they are treated by a team of qualified healthcare professionals, and there is no medical reason to require the same physician to be handing out the medication that was prescribed. For example, what if my cardiologist had an emergency and had to be somewhere else? I mean, you would not expect me to have to come back and see that same physician to simply receive the medication that I'd been prescribed. So this is a really unique restriction, and honestly, the intention behind this restriction is to make it more difficult for women in the state to access abortion care.
We're talking about the law in Wisconsin and abortion. Mike Murray of Planned Parenthood is with us. Here on the Ideas Network, we're taking your calls, your questions about medical abortions and whether you think state laws should change or stay the same. 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina, and our conversation continues here on The Morning Show. Our conversation is about abortion access, from state laws to women's health care in a pandemic. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Guest Mike Murray is President of Government Affairs and External Regulations for Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. He's answering your questions. Want to hear about your experiences, too, at 800-642-1234. What kind of stigma do you see abortion carrying? Have you had an abortion, and how has that affected your life? Now's the time, 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Mike, you just compared abortion care, specifically medical abortion care, to other procedures, for instance, a heart event. And yet, Kristen Knupson, who's the legislative director of Wisconsin Right to Life, said that abortion is not health care. She said it cannot be compared to a biopsy or to even a, you know, a birth control procedure. What do you have to say to that?
What I have to say to that is that I think that we can all acknowledge that folks may have different personal feelings about abortion care, and some people might actually might have conflicted feelings about that. But what the vast majority of people can agree on is that deciding whether or not to have a family or to end a pregnancy is one of the most personal decisions that a woman can make. And the person who is in the best decision, in the best position to make that decision, are women who are going to make that decision for themselves and for their families, and that decision should be left to women and the healthcare professionals that are providing them care. The fact is that 77% of Americans want to make sure that women continue to have access to this type of care. They do not want to see Roe versus Wade overturned, because people realize that this is actually incredibly personal and necessary care that lots of women in the state of Wisconsin and across the country need. And the fact is that, you know, just to contextualize this a little bit more, is that our state laws in Wisconsin have made it incredibly difficult for women to access this care. 96% of Wisconsin counties do not have an abortion provider in them, and 2/3 of Wisconsin women live in those counties. So that is a real and substantial burden to accessing necessary care for women across the state, and that is why we are in court right now challenging these types of restrictions that make accessing this care incredibly difficult for the vast majority of women in Wisconsin.
We're taking calls at 800-642-1234, and Katie in Madison wants to join the conversation. Hello, Katie.
Hey there. Just wanted to say thank you. I had a question about, how the Plan B pill compares to the medical abortion pill when women can buy that over the counter and administer that themselves. I'm just curious about the difference, how that works and why it's got a different legal requirement.
Katie, thanks for the question. We really appreciate your call. Mike, what about that?
So I think, thanks, Katie, for your question. I think what Katie's asking about is what most folks would call emergency contraception. Mm-hmm. Emergency contraception is a different type of medication than the types of medication that are provided for a medication abortion. Emergency contraception actually is similar to other types of hormonal contraception that actually prevents a pregnancy from occurring. The type of medication that is used for medication abortion is actually used to end the pregnancy. So they are different types of medication, and you know, anything beyond that, I think, would be beyond my level of medical expertise.
Sure, but one you can use before conception, one after, and they're different
right.
things, which is one of the reasons they do have different restrictions in Wisconsin. Is that fair?
And I think, possibly other side effects as well.
Sure. You mentioned all of these reasons that Planned Parenthood is in court right now when it comes to access. If you're successful in this lawsuit, how would that expand access to abortions across Wisconsin? What would that look like?
So, as I said before, abortion access is incredibly restricted in Wisconsin. I was at a national conference a few years ago where I was on a panel, and the panel was Wisconsin and Texas, because Wisconsin is sort of considered to be a peer state to Texas as far as the severity of our abortion restrictions. And I'm not sure that's how everyone thinks about the kind of status of abortion laws in Wisconsin. So we have really significant restrictions that have greatly diminished the ability for folks to provide and access this care across the state. So if Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin was actually successful in this lawsuit, and all three of these laws were struck down, and on appeal, if that decision was appealed and the decision was upheld, That would mean that far more patients across the state would have access to this care, because we would be able to integrate medication abortion care into our 24 health centers across the state, which means that women that need this care would actually be able to access it at the Planned Parenthood Health Center that's either in or near their community. As I said before, you know, 2/3 of the women in the state don't live in a county where they have a provider who can provide this care to them. And if we are successful, it would just greatly expand the availability of this care to women across the state.
We're looking at Planned Parenthood Wisconsin's lawsuit against laws that the organization says make it harder to access abortions. We've got Mike Murray with us with Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Republican state lawmakers tried and failed to hire their own lawyers to defend Wisconsin's abortion laws because they didn't trust Attorney General Josh Call to do it. Planned Parenthood endorsed Call in the 2018 election. Why did Planned Parenthood file this lawsuit shortly after Call was elected?
We filed this lawsuit because the lawsuit was filed based on what we think are the merits of this case regarding the existing state statutes. It was something that we had been examining for a long time, and the reason that we filed these is because these three specific statutes are incredibly burdensome for patients to access the care that they need, and we believe that is our obligation to make sure that we are advocating for laws and changes to laws that serve the needs of the patients in the communities that we serve across the state.
But these laws, they aren't necessarily new, right? They didn't go into effect and then you filed suit right after.
Correct. One of these laws has been around for a decent amount of time, and a couple of other laws are relatively new, passed within the last 10 years. But based on additional decisions that had come from the U.S. Supreme Court that demanded that there be some additional scrutiny from courts about the medical justification and the evidentiary record in support of these types of restrictions, we believe that it was important to file these lawsuits when we did.
Do you think you have a better shot now than you did in years past?
I mean, the reason that we filed this is because we think that the case law and the facts are on our side to hopefully overturn all three of these laws.
Abortion is a polarizing topic, and you've acknowledged not everyone agrees with the same ethical considerations, and that hasn't been our conversation. But I do want to know how you think people in Wisconsin would feel or handle the fact that Planned Parenthood Wisconsin could prevail in this suit.
Well, as I mentioned before, you know, folks have a wide range of personal feelings about abortion care. But what we also know is that despite the fact that some people might have personally conflicted feelings about abortion care, the vast majority of people want to make sure that women are able to access this care when women believe that they need this care, and that when they do access this care, that they are receiving accurate information, and that they are receiving high quality and safe health care. And that's exactly what we're proposing with this lawsuit, is that we want to make sure that women have access to safe and legal health care when they need it. And the fact is that every time we see polls around this, over 75% of the American public says that they want to make sure that, regardless of their personal feelings about abortion, that they want to make sure that women have access to this care when they need it.
I understand that the other side thinks they're right, that you think you're right. What does happen, though, if you lose in court?
Well, if we lose in court, we'll continue to do what we always do, and that is making sure that we are doing everything we can within the confines of existing laws to meet our patients and our communities where they're at and provide them with the health care that they need. I know that this conversation is largely focused on abortion, but Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin provides a really wide spectrum of health care to patients and communities around the state. We provide comprehensive family planning services, STI screenings and treatment, well person visits, cancer screenings, and really important community health education. So we're going to continue to provide all of those services in the best and most effective and safest way possible. For for the foreseeable future, regardless of what happens with this lawsuit.
Mike, thank you for breaking this down for us and helping us understand your perspective.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Mike Murray is the Vice President of Government Affairs and External Relations for Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. He's also the Executive Director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin, which is the nonprofit organization's advocacy arm. And we've been talking about a lawsuit filed in January of 2019 that challenges several Republican-backed state laws, including one that allows only doctors to perform abortions, including medical abortions. Up next is news. Then we'll talk with a reporter from the USA Today network about the state of contact tracing in Wisconsin and a new app that can alert people who may have been near someone with COVID-19. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for being with us on The Morning Show. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Public health officials have at times given up on trying to keep track of who's exposed to COVID-19. It's just too many people. But now there's renewed strategy in contact tracing. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing a new digital push to promote public health and track the spread of COVID-19. And we're ready for your calls at 800-642-1234. How much information do you know about the spread of COVID in your workplace or your schools or your neighborhoods? Have you been contacted by someone who was tracing COVID-19? What do you wonder or worry about when it comes to government systems keeping tabs on the spread? 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Madeline Heim. She's a health and science reporter with USA Today Network Wisconsin. Madeline, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Governor Tony Evers' office announced the launch of this new Wisconsin exposure notification last Thursday. What is this?
Yeah, so this is a contact tracing app that is actually being used in a few other states as well. And it's going to use Bluetooth technology to help notify people's close contacts that they might have been exposed to COVID-19. So this is kind of just a new approach that the state is trying to take to help us boost our contact tracing efforts. So I think the theory is people will download this app and they'll have it turned on. And if they test positive, they'll get a code to enter into that app, and that will trigger an alert to other devices that you've shared a Bluetooth signal with in the past few days, which would be the days that you might have been contagious and spreading the virus. So it's just kind of letting those other close contacts know that you might want to monitor yourself for symptoms because you've been exposed to a person who tested positive for COVID-19.
What information will users have access to through that app then?
It's kind of scarce details at this point because the state has just released their press release about it. So we're kind of waiting on some other information. But I believe it's just kind of it all surrounds that code that you'll get when you test positive. And, you know, if you have the app yourself, and then if other people that you've been in close contact with also have the app, that's how it'll function correctly, because, you know, they'll pick up those Bluetooth signals and be able to alert the other person that you've come in contact with an infected person.
So we can talk more about the app and the theories behind it. It seems like health officials are trying to make it easier for us to let people know. And yet that also still requires us to let people know. And it can be kind of embarrassing a little bit, or people might feel ashamed if they have tested positive for COVID-19. And whether they should is, you know, up for debate. But goodness, it feels like there might be a barrier there in convincing people not just to get the app, but also to plug in the code that then sends it to people I know that says, hey, by the way, I tested positive. You probably want to quarantine. Do you see that?
Yeah, I think, and I don't think that's, just related to the app, like you said. I think that's something that actually contact tracers have struggled with you know, for decades, as long as they've been doing the practice, because, you know, no one really wants to get the call that, hey, you tested positive for X, and now we have to notify all your contacts. That's just kind of a, you know, it might be embarrassing for some people. But I think that, you know, in order for it to work well, people in public health would tell us that, you know, you have to kind of get over that hump, get over that embarrassment. You know, it's okay. And especially with something like COVID, where, you know, people are going to get it, you know, if that's just how it's going to be. And so, you know, it kind of helps to just get over that embarrassment and just kind of help out to stop the spread, because ultimately that's what we're all trying to do.
Right. It's so contagious that even if you're taking precautions, the chances of exposure when you do anything, you know, are up significantly with so many cases in our state. So it's not an indicator of reckless behavior. And yet those thoughts in our heads can kind of put us at odds with contact tracers. I mean, how has their work changed throughout this pandemic?
Yeah, so I think, you know, contact tracers have been working really hard, but also struggling because, you know, on the one hand, like you said, that embarrassment, people might be embarrassed to talk to them. But also, I think increasingly people are hostile or, you know, angry and don't want to talk to them and don't want to share their personal information because they think it's going to be used in some sort of way that it's really not. It's really just to kind of let people know that they should probably quarantine because they might get COVID. So, you know, tracers have been bearing a really heavy burden ever since our cases started escalating. I mean, it's easy to do you know, a couple cases a day. In my reporting, I had talked to some tracers and they said, you know, the best, most seasoned tracers can do probably 5 cases a day because it takes over an hour to do a full case. When you have to, you know, look up all the patient information, do an extensive interview with them, let them know, you know, how they should be proceeding, and then enter all that information in and call their contacts, that you can imagine that takes a long time. So with the huge escalation in cases, that places a super heavy burden on tracers if they can only get through 5 a day at best. And now we're having, you know, thousands of new cases come in per day. So it's been difficult for sure.
Right. We can do some quick math here. And if the best can cover 5 cases a day, and Wisconsin's average daily case number is down to 2,800 confirmed cases a day, that's 14,000. That's crazy.
Right. Yeah. And you know, there are definitely people out there, and even I myself have thought this, well, why don't we just hire more contact tracers? But at this point, and actually at our peak, I think we would have even needed more than this. Some estimates show that we'd need almost 18,000 contact tracers to keep up with the current load. And you're just not going to find 18,000 tracers that are willing to just come on board, and it would take forever to onboard them. So you really kind of can't just chase the virus by taking up more contact tracers, which is something that DHS Secretary Designee Andrea Palm has said quite a few times, that you can't just keep hiring more and more and more contact tracers because, you know, that we need thousands of them.
Madeline Hine is a health and science reporter with USA Today Network Wisconsin. She's reported on how Wisconsin officials won't give details about COVID-19 outbreaks in school districts. She's also talking to contact tracers. She's covering all aspects of this public health circumstance. And right now we're focused on contact tracing. And we want to know, what are your concerns about COVID-19 and contact tracing? If someone has called you up or sent you a message, would you be willing to be honest with them about who you'd seen? And are you interested in downloading this app that the state is pushing that launches tomorrow? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. And Madeline, this does bring us back to the app, because if you simply can't bring on a bunch of contact tracers, then what other option do you have except trying to find ways to meet people in, I guess, more passive ways than just hiring more contact tracers?
Right. Yeah. And you know, that gets to the app, but it also gets to all the other ways that counties have really gotten creative, and especially at their very peak. You know, they were trying a bunch of different things. Some of the counties around where I'm based in the Fox Valley were training people at their local UW system schools. They were training people in their K-12 schools that are open, police departments and businesses on how to do their own contact tracing. So they were kind of, you know, sending out those people to say, hey, can, you know, here's how you do it. And then can you do it on your own? And then they also were triaging. So they were prioritizing people who were either at the most risk of spreading COVID. So people who would be in, you know, congregate care settings like nursing homes or jails or prisons. And then people who are at risk of getting super sick. So very old people or people with underlying conditions. So they were kind of starting with those folks first and then moving on, you know, if they had time in a day to, you know, younger, healthier people that might, you know, that might be okay if they didn't get to them right away. So those were kind of some creative ways that they tried to handle the surge. And luckily, you know, we're down from our huge peak of, you know, 6,000 plus cases coming in per day, but it's still a lot right now. So I think that's, you know, in part why the state is going to try to use the app, and we'll see how that goes. You know, in other states, you know, at first, only, you know, 3 to 5% of residents were using it. In other states, an uptick wasn't going very well. But then, so it's run by Apple and Google, and they switched to a new approach where people don't have to go into the App Store and download it themselves. It just comes up as a notification, like, hey, you can download this if you want to, or you can enable this if you want to. And that's how Wisconsin's going to work, I believe. And that, I guess, helps people, you know, they don't have to physically go in and download it. And then that did kind of increase the number of residents who wanted to buy in. So, for example, in California, when they launched their app, they got 10% of their entire state to buy in, like, just a few days after. And that's, you know, it's not amazing, but it's higher than, you know, 3 to 5%. So I guess we'll just have to kind of see how many people in Wisconsin are willing to opt into this, because, you know, like DHS has said, the more people do it, the better it will work. You know, if 100 people do it, that's, you know, it'll help out them, but it might not help out, you know, the greater state as much if not very, very many people are in it.
We're talking with health and science reporter Madeline Heim, who stays with us as we go over the latest on contact tracing for COVID-19 in Wisconsin. And I want to correct my math just a bit. We have 2,800 new cases averaged per day in Wisconsin. And if contact tracers can deal with about 5 cases per day, that means we'd need 560 contact tracers every day following up and finishing that work. So contact tracing, a huge lift even in Wisconsin as the numbers are trending down for COVID-19. Cases. We're talking about contact tracing, the challenges that we face in trying to alert people to their exposure to COVID-19, and we're taking your questions at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We're talking about contact tracing here on The Morning Show. Our guest is reporter Madeline Heim. I'm Keely Boltina. And contact tracing has been used for decades to try to deal with contagious disease, to follow up on it and try to help people who are exposed quarantine so they don't walk around spreading it to other people. And yet with the COVID-19 pandemic, so much of it is a challenge. You can join us here on the Ideas Network. There's still time for your call, and there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of contact tracing? Do you wonder if it's effective, or are you hesitant if a contact tracer were to call you up to provide your information? What do you want to know from a reporter who is covering this? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Madeline, how could this contact tracing app, if people pick up on it and use it, help public health officials? We've talked a lot about how it might help individual people, but how does it help public health officials?
Yeah, well, you know, it comes down to timing with contact tracing. There was a study that was done in the medical journal The Lancet in July that found, you know, if you can test and trace right after you get a positive result, so that also relies on the testing, but, you know, tracing as well, you can cut the future transmission of the virus down by up to 80%. So that's cutting a lot of future transmission down, you know, if you can test and trace right away. If 3 days goes by in between, that falls to 42%, so it gets almost halved. And then if you get a week behind, you're actually stopping less than 5% of future cases. So it's really, you know, it helps out all of us and public health officials to look for ways that we can shorten the time between getting a positive test and getting that tracing done. You know, if we can make as little time between those two things as possible, then we can actually work on cutting transmission down and, as they keep saying all the time, slowing the spread. So, you know, if we can use that app, if enough people buy in and, you know, you can get notified right away that, hey, I've come in contact with someone who tested positive and, you know, I should stay home, I should start symptom monitoring, and, you know, you don't have to wait 5 days, 7 days for a contact tracer to be able to finally get to your case and call you, then that's, you know, 7 days that you stayed at home or stayed quarantined instead of going out and not knowing that you were exposed. So it's really that timing element that's going to, that would help if the app goes successfully, you know, in cutting down, slowing the spread, like all of us want to see.
And I can't help but then think about the timing of how COVID-19 actually takes over in the body, because we know that people are contagious for days ahead of the time that they develop symptoms and then would get tested and then would get a positive, so that contact tracers could even begin to try to keep people at home. So are contact tracers, at least when it comes to COVID-19, up against a bigger challenge than if we'd see symptoms right away when someone was contagious?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, and that's, I think that's why the app, and, you know, I'm not a tech reporter, so I can't say for sure exactly how this is going to work, but I think that's the purpose of the app, you know, being able to pick up on the Bluetooth signals that you've shared in the past couple days, and not just, you know, in the moment, because then they are accounting for that, you know, 2 to 4 days prior, when you might have been contagious but not yet showing symptoms, but you might have, you know, gone and hung out with your friend or something like that. So that is accounting for that. But I do think that's a challenge, you know, if people don't know that they're sick and they're still going out and going around, then, yeah, they might be spreading it to more people without knowing it.
And if you're dealing with longer amounts of time, whether it's between the positive test and contact tracing or just not knowing that you have COVID-19, I imagine contact tracers face another obstacle, and that's just people trying to remember if they have been out and about, who they've seen or where they went over the past week.
Yeah, definitely. And especially because, you know, a lot of us haven't made a lot of new memories in our brains to help us remember what times we did things in the last several months while we've been staying home. But contact tracers have kind of a creative solution for that. And this is something that I think they've always used, not just with COVID. But, you know, helping people by asking, okay, well, you know, what did you eat for dinner last night? You know, just kind of trigger questions to kind of help them get back in the moment of, okay, what was I doing like on Thursday? You know, like, did I watch a certain TV show or something? You know, helping them bring them back to the moment. And then, you know, from there, they might remember, oh yeah, like on that day that I watched that show, I also went grocery shopping, you know, things like that. But you're right. It's definitely hard to remember. And especially now when we don't do a lot of things outside the home.
Yeah. And it's not just making a list then. It's real investigative work, and those conversations take time. And now we've kind of come full circle on that. Madeline Heim is a health and science reporter with USA Today Network Wisconsin. And she's reporting on contact tracing efforts through local public health departments and dealing with the state. And Madeline, that's where I'd like to go next. I mean, what metrics for success does DHS have, or do local public health departments have when it comes to contact tracing? What do we know as the public?
Yeah, so local public health has some more robust metrics, I think, in some places. So, you know, some counties, and maybe more than I actually know of, but I know some for sure, are tracking. They track a couple things. They track how many positive cases they've reached in 24 hours. And then they track how many close contacts they've reached in 48 hours. And, you know, back in the summer, in early summer, when our cases weren't super high and crazy, a lot of the places that I was watching, and a lot of them happened to be in western Wisconsin, actually, the counties there, they were doing well with that, you know, and I believe, you know, some of the counties in the north as well, Marathon County, I know, did this, and Wood County, and they were both meeting those metrics. You know, they were reaching all of their positive cases in 24 hours and all of their close contacts in 48 hours. And, you know, that's huge. And of course, as the cases started to swell, that that wasn't working quite as well. But so at the local level, you know, they're tracking things internally, I'm sure, and then they had those made public as well. As far as the state, we know a little bit less. We know a lot about, you know, the state's testing practices, but I don't think we know as much about the tracing, you know, besides the fact that they were shooting to hire 1,000 new tracers to help with contact tracing efforts, which that has happened. We have about 12 or 1,300 now, I believe, and most of those are working in local public health, and then there's also a small state team to handle surges. But we don't know at a state level, you know, how quickly residents are being reached after they test positive and how long it's taking to reach those contacts. And we also don't know, you know, we as the public can't use contact tracing data right now to see how and where the disease is spreading in Wisconsin. Some of that is tied up in a lawsuit from the state's leading business lobby, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. But we just don't know a lot about, you know, we can't use that contact tracing data publicly to know where things are spreading. And we don't know, you know, much about the success statewide. I had asked DHS about that in the summer, and they said they were developing kind of a framework to track that, and that might have come about internally, but I don't think I ever saw it publicly. So we do know a little bit less, you know, on the statewide level, and that may be because, you know, maybe it's just harder to track at that broad of a level, and maybe they'd prefer counties to just track it themselves, but yeah, we do know a little bit less from the state.
And we've covered so much in this conversation. What are you watching right now as this pandemic continues and the disease keeps spreading?
Well, you know, I think one point that I did want to make, and this is something I've heard from a lot of experts, is that, you know, contact tracing doesn't have to be perfect to be good. You know, we can't let perfect be the enemy of good. So there are some people who think, you know, okay, if we can't contact trace perfectly, what's the point? You know, why don't we just not do it? Why don't we just spend our money elsewhere? And that's definitely, you know, one way to think about it. I'm kind of an eternal optimist, so I choose to think about it as, you know, it's good because, you know, even if it saves one person's life by letting them know that they should quarantine, then that's a good thing. You know, but it will be interesting, you know, especially with the app rollout. I think it'll be super interesting to see how many people participate in that. If it works, you know, it might work somewhat. I guess I'll just be most interested to see how much of a buy-in that gets and how interested people are.
And Madeline, thank you so much for joining us. Madeline Heim is a health and science reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. And we had a conversation about contact tracing. Thank you so much, Madeline. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.